This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Once you know what you are looking for, you can see diet culture everywhere. It's in our food packaging, clothing sizes, and even airplane seats. It idolizes thinness while demonizing certain foods and larger bodies. But there are some holes in the science that prop up diet culture, and a growing community of medical experts say that weight is not the final word when it comes to determining health. On this episode of our series Embodied, we are deconstructing diet culture. Joining us first is Christy Harrison. She is an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health. She's also the author of the book Anti-Diet: Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-Being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And before we get too deep in today's conversation, I want to acknowledge that we have all heard, maybe even from our own medical provider, that it is important to manage your weight and regulate your food intake, and weight is an important marker of health. And the research that we're going to be talking about today challenges a lot of that data and a lot of the assumptions that we all hold about health in our bodies. So it may bring up some big questions for you. And if that's the case, please send those our way. Tweet us at State of Things with the hashtag embodied, or send us an email, sot@wnc.org. Today's show is not a substitute for medical or health advice. So with that out of the way, Christy, let's dive into diet culture. It is the water that we are swimming in. There are obvious examples like magazine covers, advertising, shedding 10 pounds, but it's so much more than that. Can you describe kind of what constitutes it in the way that you define it?
Yeah, so diet culture is this overarching system of beliefs and values that's really endemic to Western culture at this point in history. And the system of beliefs worships thinness and equates it to health and moral virtue, promotes weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, both moral status and health status, demonizes certain foods and food groups and ways of eating while elevating others, and oppresses people who don't match up with its supposed picture of health and well-being. So those are sort of the general principles of diet culture, but it manifests in so many different ways, from overt diets that tell you to lose weight and those cover lines that say drop X number of pounds, to like the old school Weight Watchers and, you know, sort of having weight watching in the name, to the more sneaky manifestations like the new school Weight Watchers, where it's WW and it's all about wellness. And, you know, diets calling themselves plans, programs, protocols, lifestyle changes, resets, reboots, and saying, oh, it's not a diet. This is not a diet. This is a lifestyle change. This is a way of being. So all of that really falls under the umbrella of diet culture, because it all upholds that same system of beliefs and values that's been around for the last 150 years.
Well, how did we get to this point? Because one of the things that your book does is it really starts and kind of lays out this deep, long history back to ancient Greece, and shows us that it was not always considered an undesirable thing to be fat. So take us back to that and help us understand that history.
Yeah, so really for most human civilizations around the world, for most of history, being fat was actually desirable, right? Fatness was seen as a sign of wellness, of having enough food, of wealth and well-being, and, you know, sign of fertility. And thinness was seen as a sign of poverty, illness, death, infertility, weakness. You see that in a lot of the language that's been used around the words fat and thin in cultures throughout history. And sort of the first earliest recorded evidence that I could find of fat being demonized as a bad thing, or being sort of considered anything less than desirable, was in ancient Greece and Rome. There were really conflicting ideas there, though, about what fatness, quote unquote, meant, because on the one hand, you had still the language of, you know, fat being associated with wealth, fertility, well-being, and thinness being associated with sort of the opposite of those things. And aesthetically, the sort of medium fat aesthetic was sort of desirable, seen as desirable. You know, plumpness and curviness was seen as a good thing. But on the other hand, you had ancient Greek and Roman, really starting in the ancient Greece, physicians starting to say that fatness was a bad thing. And this wasn't because of, you know, scientific evidence at the time. This was because of a belief system that ancient Greeks had about balance and moderation in all things being seen as a virtue. And so fatness was seen as an imbalance to be, quote unquote, corrected, the same way that thinness was seen as an imbalance, and that, you know, people needed to be aiming for this supposed perfect middle ground. And so fatness started to be demonized. And this is where we get the word diet, by the way. The word diet comes from the ancient Greek dieta, which means basically translates as regimen, a regimen of food and movement practices. And in the ancient Greek or ancient Greek times, it was also, you know, bathing and sexual practices were thrown in there as well. But this idea of, you know, eating in a certain way and exercising in a certain way in order to achieve a certain ideal of health. And when you read these early writings, it's pretty wild to look at the sort of assumptions and meanings they're layering on to different diets. It's, you know, people who are morally correct and doing the right thing are eating in the way that's prescribed by ancient Greek physicians. People who are not doing those things are, quote unquote, barbarians. Right.
Well, that's so interesting, this question of virtue and morality, because even in preparation for this show, it was really clear to me in conversations with people that when we're talking about health, we're really talking about so many more things. People feel like the way that their weight is or the way that their health beliefs are really integrated into kind of their core value system, their core system of morality about the world. So it seems like that was cemented as kind of marks of social status or marks of social philosophy really early on.
Yeah, it started to be then, although interestingly, as you know, after the fall of Rome, those ideas started to fade away and fatness became a virtue again, or a positive thing, or at least a morally neutral thing in a lot of most civilizations around the world, I would say. So the anti-fat belief system was sort of planted back then, but then it kind of went underground for a long time and really saw it emerge again in the 1800s in the U.S. when racist ideas about which ethnicities and which, you know, genders, also misogynistic ideas about the value of different bodies and of different people, was really in the foreground. And that started to lead to a demonization of fatness, because early evolutionary biologists who were working around that time started to point to fatness as a mark of, quote unquote, evolutionary inferiority, because people who had more fat on their bodies were supposedly women and people of color and groups that were being demonized at the time. And, you know, there's political reasons for that too, right? Justifying slavery, justifying misogyny and the oppression of women. So it really comes out of this oppressive belief systems, these systems of oppression, the idea that fatness was bad. And so it became, you know, the ancient Greek ideas about sort of the moral correctness of thinner bodies kind of came rushing back at that time.
Well, how about this question of health? Because even if people say, you know, sure, I can say that it's, you know, I'm morally neutral on whether fat is good or bad, which there's a lot to unpack there. But at what point did we begin to link weight and health, fatness and health?
Yeah, it's so interesting that emergence, because really what we see in the history is that moralistic ideas about body size predated any health arguments.
Huh.
So it wasn't that, you know, doctors were doing scientific research or clinical research and finding, oh, fatness seems to be associated with poor health and therefore it's undesirable. Actually, the cultural stigma against fat bodies was emerging first. And doctors actually at the time, you know, in the mid to late 1800s, thought that fatness was protective, that having more fat on the body was a good thing, that, you know, it was normal for people to gain weight as they aged, and sort of dismissing the idea of weight loss as unnecessary and sort of a distraction from the real health issues they needed to be addressing. Meanwhile, the cultural stigma against fatness was increasing. The fashion world was sort of turning towards a thinner ideal in the mid to late 1800s, really sort of the later half of the 1800s. And so people increasingly were coming to doctors asking for weight loss tips and advice. And doctors were sort of scoffing and saying, you know, this is really unnecessary. This is, weight gain is a normal part of aging. You really don't need to be doing this. But the emergence of that anti-fat belief system pushed so many people to ask doctors for weight loss advice that eventually they sort of caved. The other piece of this was the insurance industry, the burgeoning.
Yeah, tell me about that. That's fascinating.
Oh, so fascinating. Yeah, so the burgeoning life insurance and then health insurance industries really started looking at, you know, they have their actuarial tables determining who's going to live longer, right? The life insurance industry, of course, is geared towards making money and making sure that they're having people in their insurance pool who are going to live the longest. And so they're doing this research to determine, like, who's a bigger risk. And they found from their early research in, you know, wealthy, white, middle-aged men that it seemed to be the larger-bodied men were dying sooner. And so they started to relay this information to doctors. They started to kind of coalesce behind a campaign of, you know, telling people not to be fat and having people lose weight as a way of supposedly reducing health risks. But really it was about reducing monetary risks for the insurance industry. And so that growing pressure from the insurance industry on doctors, plus the growing public pressure that was coming from people who wanted to adhere to fashion standards and the thin ideal, started to push medicine in a really anti-fat direction, so that by the early 1900s, doctors were starting to offer weight loss advice and scales were becoming commonplace. And, you know, that's really when you see the emergence of these medicalized ideas about weight.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to get much more into the medical model and the role that weight plays. I'm talking with Christy Harrison, an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health. She's the author of the book Anti-Diet. We'll continue our conversation, which is part of our ongoing series Embodied, here on The State of Things in just a minute, so please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Diet culture is the water that we are all swimming in. It's the fitness influencers on Instagram who sell meal plans and 10-day programs for resetting our bodies. It's the panic we feel when our pants get tight and we have that loud internal voice that tells us, you should not have eaten so much dessert last month. But as we're exploring on today's show, diets do not lead us on a path to true health and well-being. Still with me is Christy Harrison. She's an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health and the author of the book Anti-Diet. Joining the conversation now is Dr. Louise Metz. She's an internal medicine physician and owner of Mosaic Comprehensive Care in Chapel Hill. Dr. Metz, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And just another quick disclaimer here that some of the research we're talking about today challenges what you may have been told about weight and your body. This conversation is not a substitute for personal medical advice, but if you do have questions you want to pose to our guests, please feel free to tweet at us with the hashtag embodied or send us an email to sot@wnc.org. So, Dr. Metz, at the forefront of many people's minds when we are talking about this conversation and as we're hearing Christy kind of outline this history is this big red flag of like obesity, the obesity epidemic, but we can't do things the way that we used to back in the 1800s because our food system looks so different and we have this mass public health epidemic today. So what is your response to that pushback to kind of thinking that the medical model shouldn't talk about health or shouldn't talk about weight?
So I think it's helpful to really look at the research on weight and health. And before I do so, it's important to note that I don't use the terms obesity or overweight unless I'm referring to the research. But in general, when I'm doing my clinical work, I use the terms higher weight or larger body. But when referring to some of the research, you'll hear those words. But I think it's helpful to look back at even the history of the BMI. So the body mass
Tell
index.
Tell me about the history of the BMI.
It's very interesting. So it was actually originally created by a Belgian astronomer in the 1830s. And he created this measure to really look at just the average size of men. And it was designed for populations, not for individuals, and was not designed to define health in any way. And then moving on later to the modern age, it was used to begin defining health somewhere in the 1900s. And then later on in the late 90s, what we found is that these arbitrary categories for BMI were suddenly changed. So the definitions of obesity and overweight were suddenly decreased, and 29 million people suddenly became, quote, overweight or obese overnight. And these changes really were not based in any research that showed that there was a direct link between these BMI categories and health.
So, Christy, you really unpacked that history and what was going on internally in the NIH at the point that these numbers and these categories got reset. And can you illuminate to some of our listeners about the origin story of this idea of an obesity epidemic and what you think may be missing in the way the conversation as we usually have it?
Yeah, it's so fascinating, the origins of this, because people don't know that it came out of just a couple of researchers looking at data on how average weights in the American population seem to have increased over time a little bit. You know, it was an average of a single-digit number of pounds between, you know, the 70s and the 90s. It was a very low amount. But they were looking at this data, and by the way, the average height of Americans had also increased during that time. But you had one researcher who's sort of leading the charge on this idea that this was a problem, that Americans' weights were increasing. His name was William Dietz. Is William Dietz. It's spelled like diets with a Z, which you really can't make this stuff up. But he, you know, was looking at this research. And, you know, he, and as I trace in my book, he and many, many other researchers who are in the so-called field of obesity research, are financed and funded by pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, by the diet industry. Many of them have their own diet plans and programs that they are selling, and, you know, have this financing that's coming from basically people with a vested interest in making Americans fear weight gain and think that their body size is a problem.
But there are, I just want to pause you for a second there, because the CDC does link obesity to a range of health consequences: high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, osteoarthritis. So people may say that it is important to talk about weight in this context because it is correlated with a number of diseases. Maybe Dr. Metz, you can take that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. So we do know that there are certain health conditions that are correlated with body size. But we talk a lot about how this is a correlation and not necessarily causation. So we don't have proof that it's the body size causing these health conditions.
What else could it be?
So there are several other mediators of that. So one could be cardiovascular fitness. So we have some data to show that that could be a mediator between body size and health. So there's one study that looked at this and found that in people who have low cardiovascular fitness levels, mortality rates were higher with higher BMIs. But in the individuals who had higher cardiovascular fitness, we found that the mortality rates evened out across body size. And that, in fact, people who were, quote, overweight or obese and were active cardiovascularly had lower mortality rates than those with a normal BMI who were inactive. So that's
one of
the correlates.
Type 2 diabetes, which I think is one of the most common ones that comes up in this, because there has been research showing that losing some weight may lessen your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So people may say, well, why not err on the side of caution? Why is it so bad to talk about weight management when we're trying to reduce things like type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, I think we're sort of asking the wrong questions and that there are assumptions behind those questions, and that it is likely not the body size that is causing diabetes, again, but there may be other mediators like genetics. So someone might be predisposed to have a higher body weight and have diabetes. And someone might be exposed to chronic dieting and weight cycling, which we might get into more, that as well as weight stigma are increasing risk of conditions like diabetes. And so that's another mediator, that it's not their body size, but it's these other factors that are contributing to conditions like diabetes.
Well, I'd love to get to that, because I know, Christy, you say that, yes, you agree that there is a correlation between higher weight and some of these conditions, but we can't draw any conclusions until we control for both weight stigma and weight cycling. So if you could kind of briefly explain both of those and how you think they cloud our picture of what we think we know about the link between weight and health.
Yeah, so weight stigma is discrimination against people in larger bodies and sort of all the outcomes of that discrimination in healthcare and across the sort of culture. Like, you know, people are told to lose weight and shamed at the doctor's office. They're teased on the playground. They're, you know, paid lower wages in the job market. And weight cycling is this repeated cycle of weight loss and regain that people undergo when they try to intentionally lose weight. And we see in the research that up to 98% of the time when people embark on weight loss efforts, they end up regaining all of the weight they lost within 5 years, if not more. In fact, up to two-thirds of people who embark on weight loss efforts may regain more weight than they lost. And so, you know, weight stigma and weight cycling are both things that are disproportionately experienced by people in larger bodies, right? People in larger bodies have weight stigma lobbed at them from every which way from the time they're children, usually.
Well, you said 2/3 of people will gain the weight back and more. That's a pretty shocking statistic. Can you explain why? What are the factors that contribute to that regaining of the weight?
Yeah, so it's really, you know, interesting and complex, and I think it basically boils down to the fact that our bodies are wired for survival. Mm. Our bodies are wired to resist starvation, and they have all kinds of biological mechanisms that kick in a situation of lack of food, right, because the body perceives that as famine. And so it will do things like turn down your fullness hormones so that you keep eating longer in the presence of food, ramp up your hunger hormones so that you're more likely to seek out food, turn down your body temperature so that you're not burning as much energy. Reduce your reproductive function because that requires energy and that's seen as sort of a nice to have but not essential function in a situation of famine. Ramps down digestion. There's just a million things, little things that your body does to help you survive in a situation of lack of food. Mm. And so, you know, that's really at the root of what drives people to regain weight, in addition to the psychology of it, which is that, you know, in situations of deprivation, we're really wired to seek out the forbidden fruit, right? And so when a food or food group is forbidden, not only do we have that physiological deprivation that's driving us back to seeking out food and, you know, helping our body get back to the set weight range it wants to be, but we also have those psychological drivers that are driving us preferentially towards those particular foods. And by the way, there's also neurotransmitters in the brain that are sort of responsible for that, that in situations of famine drive us preferentially to seek out carbohydrate-rich foods. And so that's why, you know, people's binge foods or quote-unquote trigger foods often tend to be things like chips or cookies or candy, not things like broccoli, right?
I want to play a quick listener clip that I think speaks to this question of weight cycling. This is Mark Frazier. He's a medical writer in Wisconsin, and his company recently adopted a new healthcare plan that applies credits to employees with a BMI lower than 29.9. So to save money, he crashed diets every summer before the yearly weigh-in. Let's listen to a clip.
Over the course of about 3 weeks, I lost 15 pounds by high fat, low carb, and kind of just not eating. I was pretty low energy during the entire time. I got the keto flu, which is the thing when your body is transitioning over and your electrolytes are kind of out of whack. I started getting heart arrhythmias when I do it, premature ventricular contractions, PVCs really spiked for me. My triglycerides and cholesterol and fat levels spike a lot. I can probably do it a little bit more healthy. And I've tried over the years. I get better at it. Last year, the weight stayed off for a few months, but then I was ill and just glad to be eating again. And so I've put it back on. So I'm looking forward this coming year to maintaining a healthier lifestyle and kind of maintain a good weight. But as long as I'm over that level or even close to it, I plan on doing this.
So that's Mark Frazier, a listener based in Wisconsin, talking about his approach to weight loss to earn the BMI credit for his insurance company. Getting his weight below this particular mark saves him $600 a year. I'm talking with anti-diet dietitian Christy Harrison and physician and owner of Mosaic Comprehensive Care in Chapel Hill, Dr. Louise Metz. So Dr. Metz, I saw you kind of shaking your head in dismay. What's going through your head when you hear his story?
Yeah, it's just very worrisome to me. And, you know, so the recommendations of these insurance companies and employers who offer these biometric screenings really, again, is not based in science. So it's really hard for me to hear about individuals who are feeling like they really need to engage in these behaviors to have these reduction in their premiums when clearly it's very harmful to this person and anyone's health in the short term as well as in the long term. And, you know, these are similar symptoms and signs that we see in people with eating disorders, right? So people are engaging in these behaviors that also are quite disordered and can cause, you know, severe complications of malnutrition.
So you have a very different approach in your clinic. You ascribe to the health at every size philosophy. You are a weight neutral space. Explain to our listeners what that means. What does it feel like to show up as a patient to your clinic?
Sure. So our model is very different than what you would see anywhere else. And it really starts from just walking into the waiting room. And so our weight inclusive care includes making sure that there is inclusive seating. So seating for all size and shapes bodies, as well as different abilities, and having inclusive symbols on the walls and at the check-in desk so that folks know right when they come in that we're welcoming of all people. And I think the next step that's really different than what you will see in most offices is that, as you probably know, if you go to a doctor, the first thing that then happens when you leave the waiting room is that you're taken to a scale. And it's often in a common area where other people can see this. And we completely eliminate that step. So there are no routine weights done in our office. And so patients.
Do you ever weigh patients?
So I do for rare medical indications. And if it's indicated, we do that weight privately in an exam room with a special scale that has a display that can be pulled away from the patient so they don't have to see the number. But there are rare indications, and those might include if there's a medication we're using that's based on weight, dose based on weight, and that's pretty unusual for adults. If someone has an eating disorder who is in active treatment and actively weight restoring, we might be checking blind weights. And then for adolescents, we may do height and weight just for the purpose of growth and development, and that's mainly screening for people who might be dropping off their growth curve that could be a sign of an eating disorder.
How about things like, autoimmune conditions where it can cause kind of rapid weight gain? Are there other ways that you, other health markers that you look at to be sensitive to these conditions that may be harder to track or harder to diagnose if not looking at weight?
Mm-hmm. So certainly if a patient comes in and reports a symptom of weight gain, we're going to acknowledge that and talk about it and think about what could be going on if there is something new happening in their body. So it's not that we completely ignore weight. We're not 100% weight neutral. We're going to, address someone's symptoms. But really the monitoring that weight doesn't help me help that patient. I don't need to know that number to really figure out what's going on with them. And there are other parameters that we can use, like their vital signs, labs that we can run depending on what their symptoms are.
Is there data to support this health at every size approach that it actually leads to better health outcomes for patients?
Yes, there is. So there are several randomized control trials looking at health at every size approaches. I can tell you about a couple of them. One was done by Linda Bacon, who wrote the book Health at Every Size and is a leader in this field. But that study looked at women who were, quote, overweight or obese and assigned them either to a diet, routine diet plan or a non-diet health at every size approach. And what they found in these two groups that initially at the 6-month follow-up that they did see improvements in blood pressure, high cholesterol, an increase in engaging in exercise behaviors among both groups. And they saw that weight went down in the diet group. But then if you followed them out to 2 years, we found that the folks in the diet group actually had all of those numbers revert back to their baseline. Mm. So blood pressure went back up, cholesterol went back up, their weight went back up to their baseline, and they had no sustained health benefits from engaging in the diet. But in the non-diet group, we found that at 2 years, they had sustained improved health outcomes across the board, but no change in their weight.
Christy, how about kids and children and childhood, so-called childhood obesity, and this question of whether we should be getting our kids moving more and eating less processed food to prevent poor health outcomes down the line. What is your approach to this as a registered dietitian, as a public health expert? How do you look at questions like that?
Yeah, my approach is really the same as I would take in an adult population, which is to acknowledge that diets don't work, that weight cycling is the most likely outcome of efforts at weight loss, that weight stigma and weight cycling are both independent risk factors for health problems and likely explain most, if not all, of the excess risk that we see in people in larger bodies. So I really don't recommend that parents put their kids on diets or that kids themselves try to put themselves on diets. I acknowledge that, weight stigma is so prevalent in our culture that, of course, parents want to save kids from that fate, and kids themselves probably want to escape that fate. But, to me, the solution is not to diet, because that's just going to be futile, and actually likely harmful in the long run. But to, work on self-acceptance, health at every size approaches to well-being that don't have anything to do with weight.
Well, how about that? We're going to have to continue this conversation after the break, so we have to take a break in a second, but I want to just get us started with a conversation about the food system, because people will say, well, you know, now our food industry injects salt, fat, sugar into our foods. So is it possible to give our kids or to give ourselves free access to anything we want, given what we know that our food system is doing to these foods, the additives that are happening? Maybe you can start that answer, Christy, and we can pick up after the break.
Yeah, so many things to say about that. But I think the main answer that I would give is that we actually see that in people who are not dieters, that stuff doesn't really affect them. People who are dieters, who are restricted and deprived of food, do seem to be affected by, you know, added sugars and food advertising in larger portion sizes. But people who are not dieters don't have those same effects. And so really, to me, the public health approach would be to reduce chronic dieting and tackle diet culture rather than to focus on individual choices and, you know, demonizing food companies, because I really think that that's not the problem. The issue is that we're a nation of chronic dieters.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. That's Christy Harrison, an anti-diet registered dietitian and the author of the book Anti-Diet. Dr. Louise Metz, an internal medicine physician and the owner of Mosaic Comprehensive Care in Chapel Hill. Just ahead, we'll have one more guest join the conversation. She is an ultra runner. She's going to share her experiences being an athlete in a larger body. This is The State of Things, our series Embodied. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. We are talking about diet culture on today's episode of Embodied. Still with me are Christy Harrison, anti-diet registered dietitian, and Dr. Louise Metz, the owner of Mosaic Comprehensive Care in Chapel Hill. So I want to start, Dr. Metz, actually, with a tweet that we just got that I'd love for you to respond to. So they say, the problem is that health at any size tends to somehow include the 450-plus pound people who can't get out of bed, much less be active. It is patently false and it's dangerous. People can be overweight and healthy, but at any size, no way. So that's a tweet from Liam. Could you respond to that?
Sure. So what I would say is that health at every size applies to all people. So sometimes we get that question, is there some limit at which you would not recommend a health at every size approach? And no, there is no limit. It applies to all people. So the science that we've talked about applies to everyone. You know, the harms of weight stigma and the harms of recommending weight management applies to all people. And so it is not an intervention that I would recommend for anyone, no matter their size.
And how about this question of preventive care? So even if we're saying diets don't work, the science has shown that over and over again. Is there a role for medical professionals? Should they be preventing people from weight gain? How should they think about preventive health care?
So for preventive care, we really take weight, again, out of the equation and really focus on behaviors instead. So we might talk to an individual about what are their patient care goals and what behaviors might they want to work on. So if they have been engaging in dieting for years, might they want to see a health at every size dietitian and learn how to practice intuitive eating and change those behaviors? And we really, by taking weight out of the equation, I think it allows providers time to really focus on what's important and to focus on true evidence-based preventive care, like screening for diabetes and high cholesterol and age-appropriate cancer screening. And I think the other thing that we can do in preventive care is start to steer the focus away from this heightened focus on personal responsibility, you know, that there's this idea in society and medicine that all of us should be completely responsible for our health and that we can prevent all disease or treat all of our conditions through diet and exercise, and it's just not the case. And really, as providers, we should be able to instead really support our patients in screening for these conditions and managing them as they come up.
Christy, I want to have you explain a little bit about intuitive eating and this approach that Dr. Metz has suggested and how that plays into the conversation around these highly palatable foods, as we started to talk about in our last segment. So how intuitive eating could help people kind of develop a different relationship with food that wouldn't make them go crazy when they were around a table of cookies.
Yeah, so intuitive eating is a fundamentally health at every size approach to food and nutrition. It's an anti-diet approach to food and nutrition that really helps people people recover from the toxic messages they've internalized from diet culture, helps them recover from chronic dieting, and get back in touch with their body's innate cues about food and movement. So we're all born as intuitive eaters, and you can really see this in babies, how they cry when they're hungry, they make no bones about, you know, telling the world that they need food, and then they eat their fill, they eat until they're satisfied, and then they lose interest in food until the next time they're hungry, right? They sort of turn their attention away to other things. They seek out pleasure and satisfaction. They have no qualms about eating their fill, and they're not thinking about, oh, if I have this breast milk now, then that means I can't have that formula later. You know, there's no calculus or diet culture thinking like that. And we all are born with that capacity, and we all have the capacity to get back there. It's extremely difficult in this culture because it does take us so far away from that intuitive eating skill set. But really, the practice of intuitive eating that I teach and that fellow dietitians and intuitive eating counselors teach is helping people get back to those innate cues about food and movement, to, you know what they're hungry for, know what they enjoy and like, and, you know, to think a little bit about nutrition as well in a gentle way. That's really the last of 10 principles of intuitive eating. Once you've recovered from diet culture and healed from all those internalized beliefs that are making it so difficult to relate to food in a peaceful way, then you can start bringing back in ideas about, okay, what foods would help you feel good? What foods do you maybe want to have more of in your life to support your well-being? But nutrition is not the be-all, end-all in intuitive eating the way it is in diet culture thinking.
All right, I want to bring in one more guest to our conversation, Myrna Valerio, known affectionately as the Myrnavator. She's an ultra runner. She is also the author of the book, A Beautiful Work in Progress, which traces her experience as an athlete in a larger body. Myrna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
The Myrnavator. I mean, you can't really get much better than that nickname. So we've been talking a lot in this show about weight and health and bodies and navigating diet culture. And I'd love to just start there with you. Could you talk a bit about kind of the ways that diet culture shows up in your own day-to-day life as someone in a larger body?
Sure. I can talk about an incident that just happened yesterday in my own home. My son is with me for the year. We're doing a year of travel together. And part of what he has to do each day is to go out and get some exercise. So he goes out and play basketball. He runs and does whatever he does outside as a 16-year-old. And we had a lot of carbs the other day. And he came back home and said, Mom, I need to stop eating so many carbs. And I said, well, why? He said, well, because it's carbs and carbs are bad for you. And I said, but you just did 3 hours of exercise. You have burned a lot of calories. And so you need to refuel yourself. That's why we get hungry for carbs. And so I know, even in my own home where I do really focus on intuitive eating and exercise and just being outside and feeling really, really good and mentally and emotionally healthy. Even that seeps into my own home from media, from social media, from the athletic world. And so, yes, it's, you know, even though we live in a home such as we do, it is still very, very pervasive.
So you work in a home where you encourage health promoting behaviors without necessarily tying them to weight. But I guess I'm curious for you, I mean, how do you talk to your son about weight? How do you think about weight at this point in your life?
You know, that's a really great question. He is an adolescent, and he's very tall. He's almost 6'3". And he's pretty thin, and thinner than a lot of people in my family. But he sometimes thinks he weighs too much. And he's this tall, very, very strong, strapping young man, and which is the way he should look and the way he should be, because that's his body and that's how his body has grown. But he still gets these messages that, you know, that he needs to look like this basketball player or this runner, even though his body is perfect as it is. And I really do try to to make sure that I'm saying that to him every single day. Your body is fine. You know, you're strong, you're growing, you're having a growth spurt because you are a teenager. You're still growing. Your brain is still growing, and it's not going to be finished growing until you're 50.
Well, I think something that, you know, people in any body size can relate to, given that we live in diet culture, is this kind of ongoing messaging that the size of your body and the shape of your body matters. People are looking at it. People judge you by it. And you've experienced that firsthand. I mean, you've done documentaries where you describe some of the really hateful comments and language people use about you being a larger bodied runner out running trails. How do you approach this kind of weight stigma at this point in your life?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about my experience first with medical professionals. And I actually pulled up a piece that I had written in my blog a couple of years ago, my blog, Fackerel Running. And it says, it's not very eloquent, but it says, "So I was at the doctor's today filling out a bunch of paperwork under the question, 'Anything else you would like us to know?' This is what I wrote. I was in a mood. 'Please do not ask me to exercise or to lose weight. I'm a very, very active person. I run marathons and I work out 4 to 6 days a week. I know I'm overweight and I've been working at slow and permanent weight loss for the past 5 years. Please actually read my chart before you start talking about these things. I would highly appreciate it." And so, because I had had so many instances where I'd walk into a doctor's office, a pulmonologist or a gynecologist, and they would immediately, even though I had told them that I was, you know, training for a marathon, and I wanted to make sure that I didn't drop dead during the marathon. So could they check me out and make sure I was okay? Do you exercise? I just told you I run marathons. And so, you know, that judgment, you know, we're humans, we judge people, we categorize people because it makes it easier for us to navigate socially in our society. But we do have the intellectual capacity to go beyond that. And that's what I find that I come up against in the medical profession with, you know, people out on the trail. You know, should you really be doing this? Shouldn't you just go on a diet? The questions are always, always there on people's faces. The questions about whether I really do the things that I say that I do because I'm still fat, despite the fact that I've done 14 ultra marathons and 10 marathons, despite that I train almost every day, despite the fact that I do sky running and mountain running. People always have these questions. And in fact, I was at the TCS New York City Marathon Expo, and a race director came up to me, not of that particular marathon, and asked me, you know, "Well, don't you think there's something wrong or something going on with your body that causes you not to lose weight?" In front of my family, actually. And it was a very distressing moment.
I want to put that to Dr. Metz, mm-hmm. just to kind of answer this question about size diversity and body diversity. So when someone like Myrna is active, is, you know, practicing intuitive eating, and their weight lands in the way that it does, but it is still at a higher weight, is that possible? Is that common? And is that okay?
Yeah, good question. So, yeah, so I think taking it back to that idea of size diversity, which is one of the main tenets of the Health at Every Size approach, is that, again, we all come in different shapes and sizes, and our behaviors are independent of that. So we can't look at someone and know what behaviors they're engaging in or what their health status is based on their body size. And we need to really begin to kind of separate those things. And unfortunately, as she describes it, this is so common in healthcare. So one study showed that I think 68% of people in larger bodies experience significant weight bias or stigma in the doctor's office. Hmm. And, you know, doctors really need to address that bias that we have because we're really harming people by providing that weight stigma.
And it can also lead to misdiagnoses. Is that right?
Definitely. I think that those baseline assumptions based on someone's body size are going to lead to inaccurate diagnoses. So there's typically an assumption that if someone lives in a larger body, that they must have elevated blood pressure or diabetes. And if we assume that based on body size, we'll clearly misdiagnose a large percentage of people. And the same goes for someone in a smaller body. If we assume they are healthy based on that body, we will misdiagnose a high number of people who have metabolic conditions.
Myrna, what do you wish that people better understood about life in a fat body in today's society rampant with diet culture?
Well, I can really only speak to my own experience, but I'd love people to know that, guess what? I know I'm fat. You don't need to tell me. You don't need to tell me with your body language. You don't need to tell me explicitly or implicitly. I already know that. So it doesn't help me to keep pointing that out, whether I'm out on the trail, whether I'm out on the road, whether I'm just trying to sit and be me and exist in this world as I am. Again, we do come in incredibly different sizes and shapes. You know, if you look at a marathon start line, there are so many different types of people, races, genders, ethnicities, sizes, shapes, colors. There's so many, the broad spectrum of humanity is present. And I think that's just representative of the entire world, you know? And so when you don't acknowledge that, you don't acknowledge my being, my existence. And that couldn't be good for humanity.
Totally. And I want to pause you there just because we're getting this influx of tweets and comments about this question of joint health and maybe how it has to do with physical activity. And people saying, you know, of course, carrying more weight is bad for my frame. It limits my ability to be active enough to be truly healthy. Maybe you can respond to that first, and then Christy, I'll have you respond briefly. We don't have a ton of time.
Sure. I think if I in my body, I don't actually know how much I weigh now because I've stopped weighing myself, but I'm approximately the same size that I've been for the last 12 years. I don't have any issues with my joints. I'm able to move freely. I'm strong. I am limber. You know, I am bigger than a lot of other people that participate in the same sports that I do. So the whole thing about joint health, which is the number one comment that I get, you know, you're going to ruin your knees and your back and your ankles. I'm fine.
Yeah. Christy, what does the science show about joint health and being at a higher weight?
Yeah, it's really interesting because the science really does not show that being at a higher weight definitively causes, quote unquote, any joint problems. There are some associations between being at a higher weight and having poor joint health, but, you know, some of that can be explained, again, by weight stigma, which is one of the major mediators between higher weights and poor health outcomes, such that, you know, a lot of times when people in a larger body maybe are complaining of knee pain or joint pain and go to the doctor, whereas a thinner person would get a recommendation for physical therapy and rest and, you know, stretching and strengthening and maybe surgery or whatever the evidence-based treatment is for that particular issue, people in larger bodies are recommended weight loss. And oftentimes end up then doing things that exacerbate the problem when really what they had was, you know, an alignment issue, maybe an issue where certain muscles were not doing enough work and so the joint was taking more of the brunt, which, by the way, thin people have all the time. I myself have knee problems and back problems that are because of that sort of misalignment stuff. And I, fortunately, because of thin privilege, have been able to get evidence-based medicine that I wish all people in all body sizes would get, because it's true that not everyone who is in a larger body has joint issues, and those who do, it's not necessarily caused by their weight. In fact, I would say most of the time, weight is not a cause, quote unquote. It's, you know, a sort of a red herring. And in fact, what's going on is other physiological issues that someone could get help with independent of weight loss or size.
Okay, we are almost out of time. But Dr. Metz, I just want to end with you. If you have any kind of takeaway tips for listeners who have heard this and maybe want to think about approaching their health differently or think about approaching going to the doctor differently, do you have any kind of brief takeaway points you want people to know about this different approach?
Yes, I think the things that I would say is that if you're going to your doctor, one thing is that you do not have to be weighed. It is your right to decline to be weighed. And so that you certainly can decline when you go. The other thing is to let your provider know that you would like medical care from a health at every size perspective, and that you would not want to discuss weight or weight management at your visit, that you have the right to ask for that. And another helpful quote that we learned from Regan Chastain, she will say that if the doctor is recommending something, recommending weight loss for a condition that you have and you don't think it's appropriate, you can ask, well, what would you recommend for someone in a smaller body? What testing or treatment would you recommend for someone who's thin?
Okay, thanks so much to all of our guests, Myrna Valerio, Christy Harrison, and Dr. Louise Metz. You can learn more about all of them, their research, their work, at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, and Josie Terrace. Robin Copley is a technical director. I am Anita Rao.